Welcome to the Daily French Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and we have a slightly special, more focused episode to get today. We are happy to be joined by Head of Policy at the Institute of Race Relations, Dr. Anthea Jeffrey. Anthea, how are you today?
I'm well, thanks, Nick, and hello to all your viewers.
Yes, very good to have you back to give your insight and wisdom. And the other part of the equation of great insight and wisdom is show regular, Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you, sir?
Always good to be here, Nick.
Right, so you'll see from the title that today we're going to be talking about expropriation once again, but this is an angle that I think a lot of people haven't considered or come across, and it certainly hasn't been discussed in the mainstream that much. So, Anthea, let me start off by asking this question to you. So people who are opposed to us, who support expropriation measures by the government, they say that we're being hysterical, that we're panicking far too much about what expropriation really means for the economy. They point out that even if you only can go to court afterwards to fight an expropriation, that it still can often end in a legal battle and that it happens one property at a time. And it's just a difficult process. I think the EFF said this specifically as to why expropriation was not going to have such a big effect in the way that the ANC has drafted the law. But you have been flagging something about the way the expropriation bill has defined the taking of property that should raise some concerns. Could you just explain that to us?
Right. Yes, I think it's worth noting that what Floyd Chivamba also says is that you don't want too much litigation around expropriation, and you don't want the piece of land by piece of land approach, because it could get bogged down. So what he wants, and what the ANC has also signaled in the past that it wants, is for all land in the country to be vested in the custodianship of the state. And that would automatically mean, as Julius Malema has explained, that your title deed will mean nothing if that's what you have. And there are, of course, millions of people in the country, black and white, who have title deeds to private homes, to business premises, as well as farms. So if all land is vested in the custodianship of the state, all those title deeds have no further meaning. What the ANC and the EFF are also very clear about is that this vesting of custodianship can take place without any compensation having to be paid. And they base that on two things. First of all, the decision of the Constitutional Court in the Agri-SA case. And secondly, on a definition of expropriation in the expropriation bill, which builds on the Agri-SA case to make it possible for the government to take custodianship and say it doesn't owe anybody a cent for having done so. And the consequences, of course, for homeowners and other property owners will be enormous. They lose the value of their title deeds. They do still have to pay their bonds. What kind of right they have to the land is very uncertain. They'll probably be given a land use license, which according to the EFF could last for 25 years, but wouldn't necessarily last that long because it might be in the public interest to terminate it sooner and so bring about a redistribution of land, they say, from white people to black people. Who knows? But what is clear is that once you have merely a license from the state, the government can keep changing the conditions attached to that license. And that has major ramifications, as we've seen in minerals and elsewhere.
So let me just go back a step. I think some of our listeners, they may be familiar with the term custodianship, but in this context, they might not know really what this is about. So what exactly does custodianship mean, and how is it different from expropriation without compensation? Why would it not go through the same legal process if it amounts to the same thing?
Right. I think the best way to explain that is to talk about the Agri-SA case. That case began really in 2001 when a company bought an unused mining right. And Then when the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, or the MPRDA, came into effect in 2004, that act had two consequences. First, it vested all mineral resources in the custodianship of the state. It isn't a concept that was further explained, but the idea, I suppose, was that the government would become some sort of overall trustee or custodian on behalf of the nation, that all these unsevered mineral resources down below the ground would now vest in the government, and the government would decide how they should be used. So that's the first part of the MPRDA. It said that all mineral resources, and two-thirds of them had been privately owned, would be vested in the custodianship of the state. And as Gweriman Tashe commented recently, this was done without compensation being paid, and the government is very happy with that. And the Constitutional Court accepted it effectively in this Agri-SA case, about which let me talk a little bit more, because the other side of the MPRDA was that it said, if you have an old order mining right, as Sabenza had, you have to convert it into a new order mining right under the MPRDA. And you have to apply to the state and you have to pay the application fee. And Sabenza was going bankrupt, so it couldn't do that. So its unused old order mining right ceased to exist under the MPRDA. And it had paid R1 million for it, so it claimed compensation. And when the matter went to the Pretoria High Court, the judge there said, well, all the competencies of ownership used to be with Sabenza. They were now with the government. And therefore, whether you called it ownership or custodianship didn't really matter. The fact was that what had belonged to Sabenza was now effectively in the hands of the state, and the state should pay compensation. And he put that in the amount of R750,000. Just as a side note, how did Agri-SA come into the picture? It took over the claim from Sabenza because so many farmers do have mineral resources beneath their land and would have had some sort of private ownership of them in the past. So they were interested. So this was an extraordinary thing. The government had taken custodianship, and what had cost R1 million was now in the hands of the state. Pretoria High Court said you have to pay compensation for that. But when it went to the Constitutional Court, Chief Justice Mogoeng took a totally different view. He said, and I quote, the assumption of custodianship is different from the acquisition of ownership. And if you're going to have expropriation, you must have the acquisition of ownership. And we have no acquisition of ownership. We only have the assumption of custodianship. And that means no expropriation and no compensation to be paid. So Sabenza now found it didn't have the mining right and it didn't have the money. Everything had been taken from it. And that is the great risk in the Agri-SA case and in the whole concept of custodianship, that the government thinks it can acquire all land without having to pay for it.
So, Terence, I'm going to go to you now. We've talked a little bit about minerals. Zosa Water is under custodianship. Where does this idea come from? What's its history? And how prevalent is it within the sort of ANC, EFF ideological complex?
Well, as you say, the first instance really was the water legislation in the 1990s. And at the time, I remember this was widely described as nationalization. I don't believe that there were any sort of real court challenges. Maybe Anthea can correct me on that. But that sort of set the ball rolling. I think it managed to get away with that one because water, I think in many people's minds, is seen as a kind of natural monopoly, and it's distinct from other resources. The other thing was that it was done under the aegis of Professor Carter Osmal, who was very well respected and well liked by the media and even by people in opposition, you know, as the kind of as the sort of exemplary minister. That is a questionable argument, but I think that those things managed to glide this through. Minerals came later. And I think here you went from something that was, let's say, a foundational input for life to one that has a very, very clear economic significance. fast forward a bit to the AgriSA case, and then you start seeing this the wheels turning a lot faster. Former Land Affairs Minister Gugulien Quinty wrote in the ANC's journal, I remember, that all liberation struggles are about two things: repossession of land and the centrality of indigenous culture. And he ended that article by saying the ANC will be going to Parliament to demand a sort of custodial holding of all land. Unfortunately, because the ANC has not exercised custodianship over their website very well, that particular issue is no longer available. But it made a deep impression on me, and I actually remember where I was when I read it. There was the agricultural landholding bill, I think it was called, the first iteration of which would place into custodianship all agricultural land, which would seem there to have excluded other categories like residential property. I think that the ANC Youth League possibly pushed the idea, although more conceptually than with a focus on land, when they were demanding the nationalization of the mines. I think that introduced this whole idea of nationalization, which was something that the ANC had stepped away from in the 1990s. It was widely hailed as being, you know, the economic good sense prevailing. What Malema showed was that was very much back on the table. Subsequently, 2017, released in 2018, the Land Audit, which proposed both a mass custodial taking of all land in South Africa and the imposition of taxes on top of that. So in other words, you sort of lose your asset, but you get taxed on it. Through the public hearings on the constitutional amendment, this came up again and again. Very clearly, a lot of this was orchestrated by the EFF, I think predominantly, but I think with contributions from the ANC. If anyone actually attended these hearings, there was a lot of, you know, party T-shirts, and people were clearly being lined up to sort of express themselves. There were leaked drafts of what purported to be the constitutional amendment, which we can't say for certain or genuine. Although I have seen, I do know that they were in the hands of a number of people, which suggests that there was some common origin. And some origin which a number trusted, which included things like all land will be held on behalf of the people of South Africa, along with all mineral rights, and interestingly enough, all fauna and flora. So it was, you know, the whole sweep basically of any kind of natural resource. I don't know, if, you know, flora, could you say crops being grown on land? We are now in a situation where, although we have this doesn't appear to be the official position of the government, it definitely keeps on coming up. It's like the sort of pulse light that you might see, you know, on a submarine under the water. I think that what is happening here is that there are many within the ANC that see this as the next logical step. You know, you're talking kind of about a war of position. The idea that you might have to sort of litigate confiscate piece by piece is perhaps unappealing. What the but as Anthea points out, the you can imagine all the pieces being arraigned. If the constitutional amendment goes through as it is, it establishes clearly in constitutional terms the idea that you can be deprived with no compensation. That puts the government on a much stronger footing. If suggestions that have been made by Dr. Mosheka and the committee come to pass, you will also have the courts excluded from this process. In other words, it'll be entirely in the hands of the executive. That has implications for the way any expropriation works. The Expropriation Act itself has this artificial distinction. You know, does the government take ownership of it? I don't know. You know, do you have a title deed that says this, this are the government? I don't know. But at the end, at the end of the day, it does write, it does, you know, by default write that principle into law. So what you, would have is things sort of arraigned in such a way that if the government chose to proceed, which it probably could, the way things are at the moment, it, there would simply be very, very few legal options left to challenge it.
Right. So I just want to explore that point that you finished with there a little bit more, Anthea. So firstly, as Terence points out, this idea has been floating around the world of the ANC for a very long time. Why hasn't there been a mass custodial taking of land or property prior to this? And just expanding on what Terence just said there, how exactly does the bill, the expropriation bill, and the constitutional amendment allow something like custodianship to happen? Whereas, was it possible before these pieces of legislation, or is this now a new thing that it is possible?
It could be argued based on the Agri-SA case that any assumption of custodianship is not expropriation, therefore doesn't qualify for the payment of compensation. But you would also have the property clause in the Constitution talking about, you know, just and equitable compensation on expropriation. There's also the fact that we are supposed to interpret our Bill of Rights in the light of constitutional law, and not, sorry, constitutional law, I beg your pardon, in the light of international law. And international law would certainly regard that an indirect expropriation, like taking custodianship rather than ownership, as an expropriation. So we would have against Mogoeng's judgment a whole line of authority in international law saying that, no, you're wrong, that expropriation should be payable for custodianship as well. But we also have a provision in the Constitution that says that international law can be trumped by what our Constitution says and by what statute says. So it's useful to change our Constitution and it's useful to introduce statute. And then the international law argument begins to weaken. So first of all, you change the Constitution itself. And you say that no compensation may be applied when land is expropriated. It creates simply the principle that no compensation may be appropriate. You go on to say that Parliament must decide in what circumstances no compensation can apply. So once you have that written into the Constitution, then you could have a subsequent piece of legislation similar to what Terence was talking about, the 2014 bill that vested all non-urban land in the custodianship of the state. Now you could say all land in the country is vested in the custodianship of the state. Even if you still have a requirement that this has to be approved by a court, that's a relatively simple thing. You go to court on the one big issue. Is it okay to have no compensation for all land being vested in custodianship of the state? And I think the court would say yes, first of all, because it would be encouraged to do so by the Agri-SA case, encouraged to say, well, we're not really talking about expropriation at all. We're talking about something else. And also, if there is any question about international law, well, that now kind of falls away because we've made it clear that we do want to have land taken by the state without compensation being paid. It makes it easier to win that argument. Secondly, we have the expropriation bill, which has a definition of expropriation, which is particularly useful. And that definition says expropriation means the compulsory acquisition of property. So this is how you draw the distinction between compulsory acquisition of ownership on the one hand, before which compensation may have to be paid, and something which falls short of compulsory acquisition, such as custodianship, which according to the expropriation bill wouldn't qualify for any payment of compensation whatsoever. Plus, whatever is in the expropriation bill trumps all laws into the future. It will prevail in the event of any inconsistency over any other law other than the Constitution, and a future bill amending the expropriation bill itself. So then we have a situation where the government's position is buttressed yet again. We now have a statute saying expropriation means compulsory acquisition of ownership by implication. So if you have something short of that, such as the assumption of custodianship, of course we don't have to pay compensation in that situation.
Very, very cunning. So I guess my next question on this is, should the constitutional amendment pass and should the expropriation legislation pass through Parliament, what will be the will there be tools to fight back using the courts?
Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, on the constitutional amendment bill, it's arguable that the procedures have been really inadequate in terms of public participation, and that's a basis on which a bill can be struck down. It's also very possible that that bill has to be adopted by a 75% majority, not a two-thirds one, because by so undermining property rights, it is also undermining the rule of law. And the supremacy of the rule of law is protected in Section 1 of the Constitution. It's one of our founding provisions. And if you're going to do anything that affects the supremacy of the rule of law, you have to pass it by a 75% majority. So that's another procedural argument that can be raised. Then when it comes to the expropriation bill, certainly on the procedural side, there can be arguments made that they haven't given enough attention to the written submissions, arbitrarily decided who to invite or not to invite on the oral presentations. But on the substance of the law, again, one can contest various aspects of it as being contrary to the Constitution, even after it's being amended. And so there will be a foundation for challenging both laws, even after they have been adopted.
Well, that's good news. And as we continue this fight, I think we'll definitely consider those options. But I just want to ask you, Terence, a little bit about what exactly happened when the state took custodianship of some of our resources, such as minerals and water and things like that. What was the practical result of that?
Well,
I mean, we still have mines in South Africa, right?
We still have mines, yes. All right. there are a couple of things. For a while, the water system seemed to be working fairly well, but I think that there were a lot of problems with the water policy in general. You know, Professor Osmal was very, very good at relating to the media. There'd always, you know, be cameras when he like opened up the 1,000 standpipe to be delivered to a particular community or whatever. Although, as was pointed out by Finance Week in the 1990s, the methodology that they used to calculate those delivery numbers was never made public. So, and a lot of that, as time wore on, seemed to fall apart. South Africa has always been a water stressed country, and I remember since the 1980s, there were warnings that South Africa was going to run into a major problem. Big drought, I think it was about 1982 that hit what was then Natal. We literally, the small town I was living in literally had its water switched off for about a period of about 6 months. You had these sort of tankers that would come around, you had to go and get a, and that was, you know, held up. This is what South Africa could look like unless we, you know, take it more seriously. Frankly, there was just the infrastructure rollout never happened. And the administration of water, particularly at local level, just fell apart. And this, unfortunately, is something that has been replicated over and over and over again, that, official ideology writes checks that its capacity can't cash, with apologies to Top Gun. That's fundamentally the situation, you know. Then now over the last couple of years, we've had repeated concerns about the last 10 years, I think, repeated concerns about the quality of water, eutrophication, and things like that. You know, research development, the kind of engineering we need to combat this has fallen away, and the quality of the infrastructure has degraded. Back in the 1990s, like, was some of the first work I did at the Institute was about local government, and the amount of water that a city like Johannesburg was losing. I mean, Nick, you'd know this. We, you know, 30-40% of water was just vanishing into leaks and cracks, and those occasional geysers that you'd have springing up on major roads. quite spectacular, but you know, also quite disturbing. That is the reality of state custodianship of water. You know, maybe if we had a sort of Swedish style or a Singaporean style or a Botswana style civil service, you know, we could do it on that basis, but we don't. We have the civil service that the ANC has intentionally politicized, and that is just not up to the task. Mining, yes, you know, the sort of mainstay of our economy had a golden opportunity during the sort of early 2000s with the commodity super cycle, and yes, our receipts went up, but not so much our production. I remember listening to a talk about this. Australia apparently almost doubled the output of its coal, or you know, got it up to 50% or something ridiculous like that. South Africa by about 3%. We were just getting more money for what we were making, but actually sinking money into this. And people weren't prepared to take that risk. And a lot of this came down to the provisions of the mining charter. You know, and the sort of knock-on effect of that, you know, went through has gone through Eskom. When you have a politicized approach, you will have a politicized solution, and often that is no solution at all, and that is essentially what we've got. Now, just imagine when you're talking about land. I have discussed this with a lot of good-hearted people who say, "Well, you know, when we can get those greedy farmers and those, you know, dreadful suburbanites to give up their golf courses and whatever, you know, we'll have space to, you know, for proper urban planning." And so, you know, do you really think that, you know, when faced between servicing the new look Guptas or, you know, the worthy poor of Orange Farm, the attention will be directed at the latter? When you have a politicized approach, you will have a politicized outcome. And this is not going to end well if this is how it goes.
Exactly. I'd also like to reiterate some of that by saying that I can't remember the exact figure, but South Africa has an incredibly small percentage of new mining projects as compared to other countries with lots of mineral resources like Australia and that sort of thing. And a lot of that comes down to the fact that with custodianship of mineral resources in the state, just mineral rights, there's too much bureaucracy, there's too little security. It's just not worth it. And so people don't invest. There's other reasons too, of course, labor and stuff, but
If I can just make one point, we've been speaking to farmers. I mean, you know, black emerging farmers. You know, whatever terminology you want to talk about, who have found themselves on the vicious end of living in state-owned property or state custodian property, whatever you want to call it. And what seems to be happening is that you know, these guys will struggle against all odds for a decade or whatever, get their enterprises working. And in part because of ideology, in part probably because of just inertia, and in part because of raw venality, they can never quite get ownership. But then, you know, somebody who's willing to put an envelope on the table, you know, decides, okay, well, that's producing now. I want it. You have a politicized input. You have politicized ownership. You know, and your farmer is out of luck.
Right. All right, to conclude this, I just want to very briefly ask you, Anthea, in sort of a minute or so, just to give us a brief overview of something else that you flagged. So we've talked about custodial taking, which is this quite disastrous idea. But there's also something that you flagged called regulatory taking. What exactly does that mean? And can you give us, for example, just a simple example of what that might actually look like when it comes to expropriation?
Well, let's take pension funds, which are worth about 4 trillion rand. And the government would very much like to see pension funds investing more in infrastructure and Eskom and failing SOEs. And its infrastructure projects are very unlikely to be well run. If we look at Medupi and Kusile, unlikely to provide a return on investment that is adequate, could even result in losses. Now, once we have this expropriation bill through, we could have what's called regulatory takings. In other words, the government passes regulations which result in losses to people, like pension people who are investing in pension savings. They can no longer get the return they would have got in the past if they if their fund managers could make a choice on where to invest. Once they're required by government regulation to invest in Eskom, for example, then both the fund and the pension savers that it represents are likely to bear losses, and there will be no compensation for those losses because the state hasn't taken ownership of the pension fund. It's just taken control of the way in which it must be invested. So again, international law, general concept of expropriation, that kind of loss flowing from regulation would entitle people to compensation. But once we've changed the definition of expropriation, then we will allow the idea of no compensation, not just for land. In fact, the expropriation bill quite expressly says that property is not limited to land. Then we could find the government enforcing regulations which cause losses to any number of industries and individuals, and then saying it's not obliged to pay any compensation for those losses. And that flows from both of these bills as well. And it's particularly a risk that has not been adequately understood in the commentary on it.
Definitely. Anyway, we're going to have to close it there. So thank you very much to my guests for giving us their insight and wisdom. If you're concerned about this issue, please lend your support to the IRR. Please support civil society organizations that are standing up to expropriation without compensation, as it is a terrible, disastrous attack on the Bill of Rights. If you enjoyed this, please share it, please like it, please spread it around, and we will see you tomorrow for the Daily Friend Show. Have a good day, everyone.